Augusta, Georgia is famous for golf.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the 2010 Masters.
But another golf course in the city, which happens to be the oldest, may close down because it's not attracting enough players. Hundreds of golf courses across the country face the same problem. C. Statura reports from Augusta.
The Augusta Municipal Golf Course doesn't have the same secluded allure as the Augusta National, where the Masters is played. But it does have stories. Caddies once began their training here in the hopes of working at the National. On this overheated afternoon, a lone golfer practices his swing, and Ed Howerton takes a cart onto the greens. Howerton manages the 82-year-old course.
Actually, most of the property of this course came from the old Camp Hancock, which was a World War I military base.
Howerton points out the trenches. You can't help but also notice the bald spots that mark the green. That's how the course got its nickname, the Patch. But Howerton knows a different story.
That's what I've heard the rationale is, that it actually came from a patch of area behind the clubhouse that used to grow tomatoes.
History aside, the patch has run a deficit for the last several years, and the city can't afford to keep it open. Many other courses have the same problem. The National Golf Foundation expects at least 500 courses to close between now and 2015. Greg Nathan is a spokesman at the NGF.
A lot of the closures are, you know, small town nine-holers that were built in the 50s and 60s.
Nathan says those smaller, simpler greens can't compete with the luxury courses that swamped the markets in the 90s. Golf course construction zoomed past the nation's interest in golf, and Nathan says that was partly because of real estate.
There was a significant demand, and still is, for that dream of having a house on a golf course. So a lot of entrepreneurs got very wealthy building golf course real estate developments.
Inevitably, the courses didn't have enough players to stay open. Public courses and golf resorts have closed in every state from Indiana to Florida and Nevada. Spike Kelly owns Goshen Plantation, a public course in Augusta. He says his course is emptier than it was 5 years ago, and that's because the number of courses in Augusta is still growing. So he's lowered his prices and gone looking for new golfers.
We aggressively attract the lady golfers. Seniors, they're a very cost-oriented group. We actually allow juniors to play free. Also gets their parents to be involved, and maybe they'll play golf out here as well.
Kelly says he's getting by, but the number of golfers is going down. The National Golf Foundation reports that in 2005, 30 million people played golf. Today, that's down 3 million. They also play less. Joe Lewis and Ralph Dees defy that trend. They are out on the course 3 mornings a week. Dees takes his time at the tee, and there's no one in line behind him.
Yeah, I see the dip. I definitely see that. We both say, man, this is such a beautiful course. Wonder why there's not that many people out here like it used to be. But when things get tight, this is the first thing you let go.
For now, Dees can afford it. With a membership at Goshen, a game of golf costs him less than $20. And that makes it a golfer's market. For NPR News, I'm C. Statura in Augusta, Georgia.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. President Obama signed into law today a new set of rules for the financial industry. They include what the president called the strongest consumer protections in history. The new law is the most sweeping overhaul of Wall Street in more than 70 years. But as NPR's national political correspondent Mara Liasson reports, it's also just the latest in a series of big legislative victories for Mr. Obama that have yet to pay off politically.
At the ceremony today, the president recalled how just 2 years ago the country was plunged into the worst recession since the Great Depression, and the primary cause was a breakdown in the financial system.
Unscrupulous lenders locked consumers into complex loans with hidden costs. Firms like AIG placed massive, risky bets with borrowed money. And while the rules left abuse and excess unchecked, they also left taxpayers on the hook if a big bank or financial institution ever failed.
The new law, the president said, would fix that problem, demanding accountability from bankers, borrowers, and consumers.
And unless your business model depends on cutting corners or bilking your customers, You've got nothing to fear from reform.
And the president promised that the most unpopular element in the government's response to the 2008 crisis would never happen again.
There will be no more tax-funded bailouts, period.
The signing had all the usual pomp and ceremony, beaming lawmakers, a few civilians on stage as proof the bill would help ordinary Americans. But there was something almost anticlimactic about the event, maybe because it had taken so long to pass and because in the end the bill got far less bipartisan support than was originally expected, as the president acknowledged today.
And I also want to thank the three Republican senators who put partisanship aside, judged this bill on the merits, and voted for reform.
The law the president signed today is just the latest in a series of big, consequential pieces of legislation Mr. Obama has passed with great difficulty through a deeply divided Congress. First the stimulus bill, then health care, and now new rules for Wall Street. But all these accomplishments do not appear to be making the president or his party more popular. As Mr. Obama signed the Wall Street bill today, a new Quinnipiac poll was released showing his approval rating dropping to 44%. And perhaps more ominously, 37% said they would vote for an unnamed Republican in 2012. Only 27% said they would vote to reelect the president. White House aides like Press Secretary Robert Gibbs seem resigned to the fact that they won't get much credit until their biggest problem, the poor economy, begins to change.
If your neighbor lost their house, and if you'd lost your job, and a pollster called you and said, "How do you feel about the president?" I don't think that it's a wild-eyed stretch to believe that you would think things still need to get better in this country.
The signing took place at the Ronald Reagan Building, just a few short blocks from the White House. The venue was symbolic. Mr. Obama has talked about Ronald Reagan as the kind of transformational president he himself hopes to be. But White House aides are also increasingly looking to Reagan as a political model for how an unpopular president with a bad economy can minimize his party's losses in his first midterm election. Although back in 1982, the 26 House seats the Republicans lost were considered devastating to Reagan, he went on to win re-election easily, a feat the Obama White House would be happy to duplicate. Mara Liasson, NPR News, The White House.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. If the economy is recovering from a severe contraction, why aren't more jobs being created? Well, Republicans and some business leaders say it's because the Obama administration has focused on new government programs in health care and new financial regulations. Some even say the president himself is anti-business. But when it comes to jobs, Mr. Obama is catching fire from both sides, with some in organized labor arguing that he has hurt workers by going too far to accommodate business. NPR's Don Gagne reports on the president's jobs predicament.
In this election year, Republicans have been running against the president and the Democratic Congress, portraying them as bad for business. Feeding this narrative has been the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, whose chairman, Thomas Bell, went through the litany of complaints at a recent job summit streamed live on the web.
The health care reform law, the financial regulatory reform bill, EPA regulations of carbon emissions, expanded liability and higher taxes on income and investment. You know, it just goes on and on.
The group also heard from Charles Schwab of the giant discount brokerage firm that bears his name.
They've actually, in many ways, put the fear of God in business people.
The trend toward deregulation began in the late 1970s with the airlines. It intensified during the 80s under Ronald Reagan and continued through the subsequent decades. That era has definitely come to an end with the Obama administration. But the AFL-CIO's Damon Silver says it was about time because the relaxing of rules had pushed the country to the brink in many ways.
The business practices that had brought us the economic crisis that began in 2007, the business practices that brought us the worst environmental devastation in my lifetime in the Gulf, the business practices that have hollowed out our manufacturing sector and taken 5 million manufacturing jobs away from our country.
As for the complaints from the chamber and elsewhere that the size of the stimulus has added to the deficit and not created the job growth the administration predicted, the president himself has been defending the stimulus in regular trips outside Washington. Ohio, Missouri, Wisconsin, North Carolina, and more. It's called the White House to Main Street Tour. Here's Mr. Obama talking to NBC on the tarmac next to Air Force One in Michigan last week.
You got to remember also that about a third of the Recovery Act last year was tax cuts. And nobody talks about it, but those were not just tax cuts to individuals. They were also tax cuts to small businesses.
To counter the anti-business label, administration figures are often accompanied by individual business leaders, such as the CellGuard Company's Robert Toth in Charlotte, North Carolina.
As you can see, we're currently expanding operations here with our investment supported by the $49 million matching grant we received from the Department of Energy last year. It's a very exciting time for our company.
But such events have not turned around public doubts about the stimulus or the president's handling of the economy in general. And the AFL-CIO's Damon Silver says that, too, came from the administration doing too much to make business happy.
The business tax cuts, pretty clearly the least effective aspect of the stimulus bill.
At the liberal think tank, the Economic Policy Institute, Josh Bivens also faults the administration for its management of the message.
I think it needs to be jobs, 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 and instead it's jobs, deficits, and they go back and forth.
And if both sides of the labor management debate agree on nothing else, they both seem to want the White House to be on their side full time. Don Gagne, NPR News, Washington.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The economy is growing slowly and job creation is not happening quickly enough, but we're not headed for disaster either. That was the message yesterday from Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke. He gave a six-month update to Congress. As NPR's Tamara Keith reports, Bernanke's visit to the Hill was low-key, kind of like the recovery.
When the Fed chairman last delivered this report 6 months ago, the recovery was just getting going. Things were looking good. But lately, there's been a whole lot of mediocre economic news, which is why Ben Bernanke said this.
We also recognize that the economic outlook remains unusually uncertain.
Unusually uncertain. Still, Bernanke is repeating a refrain we've been hearing for months.
My colleagues on the Federal Open Market Committee and I expect continued moderate growth, a gradual decline in the unemployment rate, and subdued inflation over the next several years.
When it came time for questions, Republican Senator Bob Corker from Tennessee asked if Bernanke and his colleagues had considered the possibility of the economy falling back into recession.
Do you discuss much in your meetings the probability of a double dip? And then can you give us some sense as to the future there?
Well, we certainly try to talk about all contingencies, and the committee has identified some downside risks.
Those downside risks include troubles small businesses have had getting credit and the high level of unemployment, which hurts consumer confidence, which in turn makes people unwilling to spend.
But I'd like to emphasize that our forecast, our expectation is still for a moderate recovery, which will over time bring down the unemployment rate. So that's still our main scenario.
Bernanke made it clear the Fed doesn't plan to raise interest rates anytime soon. They're about as low as they can go at this point. And given all that uncertainty and downside risk, inflation is hardly a concern. If this slowdown in the recovery gets worse, Bernanke said the Fed is prepared to get creative. Kentucky Republican Jim Bunning was skeptical.
Are you out of bullets?
Well, I don't think so.
What the Fed has left in the chamber is something known as quantitative easing.
So what does the Fed have left? What the Fed can do, has done before, and can do again, is buy stuff.
Vincent Reinhardt is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Before that, he worked at the Federal Reserve for about 25 years and even wrote papers with Chairman Bernanke about that very strategy.
The central bank has a big balance sheet, and it can make it bigger. The Federal Reserve can buy assets.
Like mortgage-backed securities or treasury securities.
The Federal Reserve can buy different assets. So in that sense, since he can resort to creating reserves and purchasing assets, he does have some bullets left.
Committee members didn't restrict their questions to monetary policy, though. They tried to get the Fed chairman to weigh in on all kinds of highly politicized issues, like the pending expiration of the Bush-era tax cuts and the balance between the deficit and economic stimulus. It seemed like Bernanke did his best not to give anyone, Democrats or Republicans, the ammunition they were looking for.
I don't think it's really my place to tell Congress which specific tax and spending policies to choose. I prefer to address the broader trajectory of fiscal stimulus.
Though he did say in the long term, big deficits are bad. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.